kuvekazu mushorsam ktizimketu eben aluliak samara nem ayan lot. In other words, if you are 12 years old or younger, you should be in school and not listening to this radio show.
You're not dumb enough to actually try it. Know your rights. These are your rights. Oh, know your rights. These are your
Welcome to the September 19th, 2011 edition of Mindenki Yoga. This is JD.
Interrupting all programs. This is Radio Clash on Pirate Satellite. Orbiting your living room, cashing in the Bill of Rights. Cuban army surplus or refusing of the lights. This is Radio Clash on Pirate Satellite.
On today's program of Mindenki Yoga, we're going to talk about Troy Davis and his possible execution this week. We're going to talk about another Arab uprising in Syria, and we're going to play some Democracy Now! With an extensive interview with Noam Chomsky. Troy Davis is an American, an African-American man in the U.S. state of Georgia. And in 1989, he was convicted of the murder of a Georgia policeman named Mark McPhail. And since then, it's been in the courts. He has appealed this decision that he was of being convicted of murder again and again, and it's a long story, and I'm not going to go into it. I'll put links on the website about every little detail about the courts, about how fair these trials were, etc. There's many doubts about the fairness of the system towards Troy Davis, but there's I think most reasonable people would say that there is reasonable doubt in this case. And there are many details as to why there is doubt about his alleged guilt. This week, on September 21st, is the execution date set for Troy Davis. There's been a call for a new trial or a look at the evidence again by the court authorities, by people like former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Nobel Peace Prize winner, the current Pope, even an FBI, a former FBI director, has called for a reevaluation of the justice system, or how the justice system treated Troy Davis. There are two issues here. One issue is whether or not you believe the death penalty is wrong, just on a moral level. And then there's the issue of whether or not this execution is wrong. And there are many people, such as the former FBI director, who actually believe in the death penalty, who say using the death penalty in this case is wrong. So I'm going to play a couple clips here. One is from a protest on September 16th in the U.S. state of Georgia in Atlanta by the NAACP, the National Action Network, and the Amnesty International USA. So listen to some of the videos here, and then after that will be a piece of an Amnesty International United Kingdom, Britain video, where you can listen to some of Troy Davis's sister talk about the case and what some of the people said as they protested in front of the U.S. Embassy in London.
We are glad to be here tonight with the NAACP and with Amnesty International and with the National Action Network. We come from many different places. Some of us are opposed to the death penalty. There are some in this crowd who are proponents of the death penalty, but we all agree tonight that Troy Davis should not be executed.
Yes. Yeah.
That justice matters, that innocence matters.
Yeah.
We are fighting not only for Troy Davis's life, we are fighting for our name.
Yes.
You must do this in our name.
Yes.
And so we are determined to fight.
Yes.
We spoke with Troy Davis earlier tonight, and I want you to know that he said he is keeping the faith.
Yes.
He spoke like a brother who trusted God.
Yes.
He is keeping the faith, and so we must keep the faith.
Yes.
We will fight.
Yes.
Until victory is won.
Yes.
We will fight.
Yes.
Until justice comes.
Yes.
Unrighteousness as a mighty stream. We will fight.
Yes.
Not only for Troy Davis.
Yes.
We fight for our children.
Yes.
We fight for America.
Yes.
Because we're not free until everybody is free.
Yes.
And here's the Amnesty International protest in London.
I had a lawyer tell me once in 2004, we know Troy is innocent. We have the proof. Everything is here. The witnesses have recanted. You know, there's no DNA, no weapon, you know, no motive. But Troy is a black man. This is the South, and he's accused of killing a white police officer. It doesn't matter if he's innocent. He's going to be executed in the state of Georgia.
Troy Davis will begin a new evidentiary hearing before a federal court in Savannah, Georgia. No sister should ever have to spend her life fighting for her brother not to be executed. No young boy should ever have to grow up knowing that his uncle could be killed and taken away from him.
Justice for Troy Davis!
Many years ago, when we started this campaign, the death penalty was being used in many countries around the world. We are winning this campaign. We will think that the progress is too slow. The progress is too slow, but we will continue our efforts until we see that day with a world that is free of the death penalty. We're stood outside the American Embassy and we have handed in a letter to the ambassador. It says that we're here in solidarity with Troy Davis and his family. And it further goes in to talk about our opposition as Amnesty International to the death penalty.
I thought that racism had really subsided in my community, but when my brother was accused of killing a white police officer, it was like all this underlying racism and classism was right in my face.
We know from our work in Amnesty that poor people and ethnic minorities are more likely to face the death penalty than anybody else.
They never wanted to hear what he had to say, and they never wanted to hear anything about what my family had to say. They just wanted to make us out to be these evil people. He didn't think that it was going to take 15 years, 20 years. He thought that the court system would do the right thing and see the truth for what it was, but that's not what happened.
Next, we're going to listen to Dori Atal, a Hungarian woman who's the campaign coordinator for Amnesty International Hungary. And this last Friday, there was a protest in front of the U.S. Embassy here in Budapest. Let's listen to Dori Atal, and she's going to explain why they were protesting in front of the U.S. Embassy in Budapest.
So I'm Dorothy Atal, I'm the campaign's coordinator for Amnesty International Hungary, and this year we are campaigning against the death penalty. We are targeting Belarus, but at this event we are focusing on Troy Davis. Amnesty International has been campaigning for Troy Davis for a long time. We are supporting all death row inmates, and we are against death penalty under any circumstances, in all cases, regardless whether they are innocent or guilty. But in Troy Davis' case, it's a special case because there is too much doubt about his case, and it's not necessary that he might be innocent. Of course, that's very important. But it's also that we think there's no way, there's no justice system, no perfect justice system which could exclude the possibility that there's a failure. There's always a failure, and that means that innocent people will be executed. And those who realize this they will abolish the death penalty. And this happened in the state of Illinois, this happened in the state of New Jersey, state of New Mexico, and there's 34 more states to go. Unfortunately, it is, unfortunately, it is the United States which executes people regularly in the whole American continent. But good news is that when Amnesty was founded, there was only 9 states who abolished the death penalty, but today there's 96, and the number is growing. And there's also countries like Mongolia, they still have the death penalty, but they voted for a moratorium on executions, and the president himself called for the total abolition of the death penalty. So we are aiming to achieve the same in Belarus as well, because this is the only state in Europe which still executes people. So Amnesty International focuses its whole global campaign, that global death penalty campaign, on Belarus, and we are collecting signatures asking Lukashenko to bring a moratorium on the execution, first of all, and with a further view to abolish the death penalty.
Okay, as I said, I'm going to put a bunch of links on the blog, on the Mindenki Yoga blog, so you can read all the details and decide for yourself whether or not there is reasonable evidence, reasonable doubt about the case of Troy Davis and that he's allegedly being guilty. So you can find the blog at lmv.hu/Mindenki Yoga, and you spell Mindenki Yoga like this, MindenkiJoga. I'll put all the stuff there. Now, let's listen to some music. This is Jessery X with his song, I Am Troy Davis.
This is Troy Anthony Davis. I've been sitting on Georgia's death row for a crime I did not commit. I will never take another human being's life. And this killer is still out there. My family's in mourning, the victim's family's in mourning, and the truth is still locked in because I didn't get justice.
Does the court system employ racists? Then why are so many black boys in cages? Why shouldn't I be paranoid of hatred? Just look at the curious case of Troy Davis. Let's travel on down to Savannah, in the state of Georgia, just south of Atlanta, where they wave a rebel flag like a bandana. Hunger ancestors then pose for the cameras. A white police officer was shot and killed over an argument he tried to stop and heal. But here's where the plot gets real. The main suspect blamed Troy, went to the cops and squealed. And with no physical evidence or weapon, Troy was arrested for a 187. He said he was an innocent man when he was questioned, but they said he did it. Who needs a damn confession? They just need a witness, they compress the crime. Tell them what to say or they'll arrest the guy. Then put them on the stand and make them testify. Swear to God to tell the truth and do their best to lie. And they did, so Troy was found guilty. Sent to death row by a scheme so filthy. Even though his innocence is true, we pray they don't reminisce over you, my God.
Almost all of the prosecution's star witnesses have changed their stories. Some saying police pressured them to say Troy Davis did. Darrell Collins is one of the prosecution witnesses who signed a police statement implicating Troy Davis.
And I told them over and over that I didn't see this happen. They put what they wanted to put in that statement.
But the truth always comes to light, and Troy Davis didn't give up the fight. He kept filing the bill until it was revealed the state of Georgia wants an innocent man killed. That's why who's who want him out, cause it's just too much doubt. And witness after witness came forward and admitted the only reason they did it is cause police insisted. So wicked, so vicious, the system's broke, so fix it. 2 decades, no Christmas, execution dates, 4 listed. Get organized, show resistance, go online, sign those petitions. Black Americans know the difference. It's a new day, but the same old lynchings. I am Troy Davis. Families destroyed by cases. Why can't we avoid the matrix? Instead of giving his children toys to play with, he's waiting his execution, hoping the court stays it. And I'm praying and doing. We need action, we need movement. Cause his innocence is true. I pray they don't reminisce over you, for real.
Brenda Forrest was one of the jurors.
All of the witnesses, they were able to, you know, to ID him.
This is how the juror feels now.
If I knew then what I know now, Troy Davis would not be on death row. The verdict would be not guilty.
It's a lot of people believe in the death penalty, but they're still working in Troy's behalf because they believe that Troy is innocent. I believe if all these thousands and thousands of people know that, believe and know that Troy is innocent, you know, God sees that.
am Troy Davis.
I am Troy Davis.
I am Troy Davis.
I am Troy Davis.
A Scholar Music Hungary szervezésében Trial koncert szeptember 23-án a Dürer kertben. A lelki, erkölcsi küzdelmeket és felemelkedést, társadalmi, politikai igazságtalanságok kritikáját páratlan intelligenciával közvetítő zenekar 95-ben alakult, Seattle-ben, Washingtonban, az Egyesült Államokban. Már kétszer tette tiszteletét hazánkban. A 90-es évekbeli underground hardcore punk zenének, mozgalomnak kiemelkedő alakjai, akik értékrendükkel, intuitív zeneiségükkel generációknak adtak és adnak szellemi táplálékot és tartást. Most újabb lehetőségünk van, hogy meghallgassuk őket, és megtaláljuk vagy éppen felfedezzük azt a pontot, ahol az intelligencia a kemény zenével párosul. Trial koncert 2011. szeptember 23-án 19 órától a Dürer kertben.
That was Jassery X with I Am Troy Davis. Also the Hungarian language part was Martin and Martin Szigeti, and he was announcing that this week on September 20th at Dürer kert in Budapest, on September 23rd at 8 p.m. Greg Benek's band Trial will be playing. You remember Greg Benek? We've had the interviews about the situation in Haiti and his direct action aid to Haiti. That guy is going to be in Budapest on the 23rd. You can meet him, you can talk with him, and you can listen to his very intense music. So, Dürer kert, 23rd of September, 8 p.m. See you there. Now, if you've been following Mindenki Yoga, we've been doing the Arab Spring since it was winter, actually. Since at the beginning of the year, we've done Libya, we've done Egypt, we've done Palestine in March. We did Israel even. We did Yemen several times. Now we're going to do Syria. There is a small Syrian immigrant community here in Budapest that goes way back, several decades. And first we're going to... there's a protest at the EU house near Milenaris Park in Buda. And the Syrian community had a protest there in front of the EU house. What's interesting is that they're not really protesting against the EU, although I'm sure they would like the EU to do more to isolate the Syrian regime of President Bashar al-Assad. But the EU had recently imposed sanctions on the EU, which, by the way, the EU buys 90% of Syria's oil exports. So the EU does have some ways of kind of choking the Syrian regime. So these new sanctions... These new EU sanctions on Syria will slowly choke off the import of oil from Syria, and that will take away money from the Syrian regime. So in the next three and a half minutes, we're going to listen to Musa Mustafa, who's one of the leaders of the Syrian community that was protesting at the EU house, and he's going to be speaking in Hungarian. So this is 3.5 minutes. So here's Musa Mustafa.
Assad család néve fényezett. 40 éve úgy került hatalomra, előtte, mint hadügyminiszter, elvesztett egy háború. De közismert történelem során, aki egy hadvezér, aki veszít háborút, az minimum öngyilkos lesz. Ez cserébe magáévá tette Szíriát, erőszakkal. De uralkodott vassal, tűzzel, halála előtt kiszemelt fia kutottként, kiszemelt fiatal, ismeretlen körülmények között halt meg, és elővették ezt a fiatal, 30, akkor 32 vagy 4 éves volt orvos, személyszorvos, aki mellesleg zárójelben mondom, azóta már GG-sz, mert most az ilyen hasonlókat Szíriában elkapják, kivágják a GG-ket, akik hiabálnak. Tényleg, két esetben is. Azért, mert azóta GG-sz ugyanazt a folyamatot folytatta, addig, ameddig az emberek már nem tűrték a gyalázatot, és követelték elsősorban méltóságukat, némi szabadságot, demokráciát, rendes korunkhoz illő korunk normáihoz illő alkotmány. Ezt nem tűrték, és vassal, tűzzel, tankokkal, repülőgéppel, hadiflottával, minden támadják a városokat. Naponta átlagosan 20 ember hal meg, de ez a nép nem hátrált. Egyszerűen ez a rendszer olyan szintre jött, hogy visszaút nincsen már. El kell, hogy takarodjon Szíriában. Ahogy a líbiai. Nem. Sajnos hosszú lesz, úgy könnyedén nem fogja átadni a hatalmát, és nem fogja maga is, nem fog arra várni, hogy sok áldozatot fog következni. Ez a lényege, amit Szíriában történik.
És ezt megkérdezhetném, hogy most ezzel a tüntetéssel itt az EU ház előtt mi a céljuk?
Mi tulajdonképpen azért jöttünk ide, hogy megköszöntük, megkértük az itteni iroda vezetőjét, hogy tolmácsolja az Európai Uniónak köszönetünket, hogy tisztességesen áll a szíria nép mellett. Ugyanakkor kértük meg arra, hogy még nagyobb gyakorlatot, nyomást gyakoroljon a szíria rendszerre. Kértük a petícióba, hogy hívják vissza a nagyköveteiket, küldjék el a szíriai nagyköveteket, minél nagyobb nyomást gyakoroljon. Sőt, a petícióban azt is írtam, hogy Európai Unió hallja a segélykiáltását a népüknek, mert bent, akik halnak, azok szinte a civil emberek védelmét kérik a nemzetközi fórumoktól, így az ENSZ-től, vagy a Biztonsági Tanácstól, az EU-tól. És ez a demonstráció, azért jöttünk, átadtunk a petíciót, meg hogy némileg fejezzük ki a szolidaritásukat a népünkkel.
That was Musa Mustafa, a leader of the Syrian community in here in Budapest, and he had brought his people to the EU house at Milanaris in Buda, just behind Mahmud Mall, if you know where that is. And let me talk a little bit about Syria, and then we're gonna have an interview with a man named Hadi. Syria has had a one-party rule for a very, very long time. A man named Hafez al-Assad was kind of the leader of the Ba'ath Party, who took over he held on to power for 29 years until his son, Bashir al-Assad, took over in 2000. So we're talking about, what is that, 40 plus years, the Ba'ath Party, and this family has ruled Syria. When the Arab Spring started in Tunisia and then spread to Egypt, very quickly in January, protests started in Syria, and then spread from there. And then the uprising got hit kind of a critical mass about mid-March. And since then, more than 3,000 Syrians have died from attacks from its own government. This is the military attacking peaceful protests. There's lots of reports from the Syrian media saying that there's guerrillas and all this, but there's no evidence of this. And you see again and again in the videos that are exported out of Syria that these are massive, massive, huge protests all over the country and in small towns and big cities alike. And these are like kind of a national uprising in a very serious way. And it is amazing, just like the Yemen situation, and just like the Bahrain situation. It is amazing that the people have been so nonviolent for so long. Now, the other thing is that Syria is very different from Egypt and Tunisia, because Syria does not depend on the West. It has more of a dependency and a stronger relationship with Iran and with Russia. So the way for the West to control things or to change things is very different. So, but you do have still some things like this. The EU buys 80-90% of the oil exports from Syria, for example. This certainly will have an effect. Also, you know the UN and NATO and EU militarily intervened into Libya, quote unquote, to prevent loss of life. But here, the protesters in Syria have asked NATO and the rest of the world to not intervene militarily and let them handle it themselves, which is a very interesting thing, very different from the Libya situation. So let's talk to Hadi. It's not his real name, but he's a student here in Budapest, and he's from Syria. And he was at the demonstration at the European Union House. And Hadi's going to explain to us like how he's felt being in Budapest while watching his country have a revolution. And you can tell from his voice that he is very upset, and it's very kind of nerve-wracking for him to watch his country go through this giant upheaval at this time. Let's listen to Hadi, a man who's a student in Budapest, who was at the protest this week. Here's Hadi. So Hadi, how did you feel with being at the demonstration at the Budapest EU House here? The Syrians had a demonstration today. What was your feeling when you were there?
Well, since the beginning of the revolution, all I could do is just watching news and following news on the internet and watching videos of sometimes even people I know who are like shot in the head. Or one day I just opened, woke up in the morning, a call from one of my friends back home, and he asked me to check my email. So I checked my email. I'm still in bed, haven't even drank my coffee, and I saw a video of one of my cousins shot in the head. And yeah, it was like the biggest shock since the very beginning. So it's always in my mind, like always like every day I talk to my family, ask how they are, and like so much tension. And when I came today and I was like, I took part in this demonstration, I really released a lot of energy. I felt that, okay, I'm far away, but at least I could do something, even though it's very, very small, but yeah, hopefully it will change something. And yeah, it felt great that, yeah, I took part of it.
So without going through the last several thousand years of Syrian history, can you explain, like, what is the regime? Like, it's a dictatorship and all this, but how does it work, and like, why do people, other than the fact that it's a dictatorship, why do people want to change this regime?
Look, I'm not going back thousands of years in the history, but just, let's say, 50 years. So during the end of 50s and the beginning of 60s, we had a lot of military coup.
Coup.
Yeah, sorry.
It's all right. It's okay.
So the country was in a big mess for like 10 years. And then the Ba'ath Party, it was established in the end of 40s, but like in 1963, the party took over, and like the party had all these mottos and like, you know, big words like the unity and democracy and welfare for people, and like, so the party had all the reasons to succeed, and so people believed in this party, and people were raised since they were born in this party. And my mother is actually was an active member in this party. And so it's like had been, I don't know, 40 something years, and people grew in this party. Like people like always, you know, hear it. So always hear what the party wants. But like this is just in theory. But the difference, I mean, you ask me what changed now, or like why people have different opinion now. Because during the 70s, or when the president, the previous president, who's the father of the current one, when he took over and he was the head of the party, Syria was living the golden age, the beginning of 70s. They did a lot of projects, a lot of dams, they rebuilt the infrastructure. It was really living the golden age. But the problem started to happen when the president and the small circle around him, they started to control the country. So in the 80s, in the end of 70s, and like the biggest event was in 82, we had the movement was led by the Muslim Brotherhood. And it was working against the government. At the same time, it was destroying the country. So the government had reason to fight this movement like with all its power. So a lot of people were killed, even like in one city called Hama, over 40,000 people were killed. Like the official number, say like 30,000. But like people from there, they say over 70,000. So anyway, so I hear stories from my parents that during that time, beginning of 80s, everyone is scared. There were attacks everywhere. People are always threatened to be in the middle of something and they die. So when the government used, like my mother always used this word, like the iron fist, to crush this movement, everybody was around the government, everybody supported the government. But when after this event, and after like they demolished the party or this movement, the government took over more and more and started controlling not people who are like they're suspicious that belong to this party, but like everyone. So other parties, they didn't have any voice. And the Ba'ath Party was like taking over more and more. So after that time, the country or the state of police started, and I don't remember the 80s. I don't even remember the 90s. But I remember, like when I was a teenager, I grew up in an environment that I couldn't even express my opinion. Whatsoever, I couldn't say anything, even because whenever I want to say something and I'm suspicious, like 1% that it's against the government, then I just don't say it. So basically, I grew up in an environment that people just don't talk about anything. So people were, I wouldn't say they were fine with it, but they were just like putting it aside. So the thing which changed in the last, I would say, beginning of 2011, after the revolution started in Tunisia, and then it succeeded, it took like 27, 28 days, and the president ran away. Okay, they're still having troubles, but this is normal. This is like normal after any revolution in the world. So it succeeded in Tunisia, it succeeded in Egypt, and just shortly after, the direct reason of the revolution in Syria, there were 15 teenage kids or teenagers between 11 and 15 years old in the city of Dara. They were arrested because they wrote things on the walls like against the government, like the same things they were hearing in the news every day in Tunisia and Egypt. So these kids were arrested and they were tortured. And then their parents went to the head of the police, I don't know what department, but they went to the police to complain. And he didn't even talk to them, and he sent them away. So they went to the governor of the region, of the county or the region, and the same happened. So all of them went to Damascus. And so many people went to Damascus and they made like small tiny demonstration in front of the Ministry of Internal Affairs. And so when they had this demonstration, which was not allowed by law, a lot of them were arrested. So the demographic structure in Daraa, it's people still, like everybody belongs to a tribe. So, I mean, everyone has a family, but not only family, but big family behind them, which is the tribe. So their people or their families or their tribes back home or back in Daraa, they started going to the street. So the whole thing started from these kids when their families start going to the street. So more people go to the street, more people are arrested, more people are tortured. And then, like from the very first demonstration in Daraa, the police started shooting, because the police mentality is not, I mean, yeah, they were not used to the idea that people go to the street and say whatever they want. So like from the very beginning, they started shooting people. So then it was going to towns around Daraa, then it was going more north, and for some reasons it skipped Damascus, and only in the very few, like the last few weeks, and there were demonstrations in Damascus. Anyway, so the thing was going like more north and north, and after, yeah, I remember like during that time, after like a month and a half of revolution, or beginning of the revolution, I was talking to my dad, and I told him that I want to go back home. So I had some reasons, I had holidays, so I want to go back home. And I said, yeah, so I asked him for his opinion. I said, yeah, we can come back home, like there is nothing. So, after like a few weeks, 2-3 weeks, I asked my father the same question, like, I want to go back home, I might be able to go or to be there like in 2 weeks. He said, yeah, if you can wait a little bit, then it's better. So I was waiting for a few weeks, and then we talked again, and he said, don't come. He said, don't come, even if you have to, don't come. So because during that time, from the beginning of the revolution till my dad said, don't come, the revolution was expanding more, and like more towns were participating in demonstrations, and more people were getting killed. And my town is in the very north of the country, which is like, yeah, anyway, so next to the Turkish border. So during that time, like it covered all the country, and every single town was going demonstrating. And now even in my town, like now in my town, the situation is the same like in Daraa in the beginning of the revolution. So people go to the street, people get shot, people get arrested, then more people go demonstrating. Even like, okay, it was like this circle, someone gets killed, they go into funeral, and during the funeral people die, I mean people get shot, and then other funeral, then people get shot. So like this circle is like now going like all over the country. So now in every single town there is demonstration. So yeah.
What stories do you have of friends or people that you know of Syrians that have and how do they do their activism or revolution within the country? I mean, how do you organize under these circumstances?
Well, as far as I know, I'm not there. I didn't go there. Like last time I was there, it was in January. But still, like since I follow the news all the time, and I have some friends, like all over the country, and like always in contact with them. There are Facebook groups. There are some websites which they publish news coming from the ground and ground zero. So I get the news from them, and I consider myself, I'm like, I don't know, like 70-80% I don't know what's going on exactly, but I know like most of it. So from what I get is that okay, I guess I lost the track, but like,
okay.
You could like.
You're knowledgeable. You follow the news.
Yeah, I follow the news. I try my best to follow the news, and a lot of my friends and I. Maybe I should repeat the story again. Some of my friends who were publishing things on the internet, on YouTube and Facebook, they were arrested, and like some videos of people were killed or were shot. I could recognize them. So you just go on YouTube and browse YouTube, and you see people, you know, they're killed. One of them shot in the eye, the other shot in the head. So I mean, this news cannot lie, because it's just right there. I mean, yeah. So it doesn't matter what the official story is, but like something you see in your eyes. So when the things were starting in Dara, or like in towns which I'd never been in Dara, but so when the news was coming from there, I was thinking to myself, okay, maybe it's just like the media is exaggerating, they just want hot news. But when I saw the things, when I saw some videos of shooting in my town, I could recognize the buildings, I could recognize some faces, I could recognize, I mean, it's my town, I know every single wall in it. So when the news was coming from my town, and like it's just right there, like things happening in place I know, with the people I know, so this news cannot lie. So it's, yeah, it's just right there.
What should I ask you? Take a drink. Yeah, yeah. How do I introduce that question? What do I ask? I want to talk about this Hungarian guy you're mentioning. We don't know anything about this.
Well,
you don't know him, or you didn't know him, or did you know him? Or?
Yeah, of course.
You did. Okay. Okay.
No, so. I know. It's like the last, like since I came here, every time I go home, I go to visit the family. Like even though my friend wasn't there, but I know his parents. I know his dad. So there's this Hungarian citizen. I don't want to mention his name because then, you know, it's directly related to me. So Hungarian citizen, he was a doctor. He practiced his profession in Hungary for over 25 years. And he's married to a Hungarian woman. He has Hungarian citizenship. So a few years ago, he decided to go back with his family home. And in the beginning of the revolution, or after like a month and a half from the beginning of the revolution, there were some demonstrations in my town. And the doctor and some of his cousins, some of his friends, they participated in the very first demonstration. So after a few weeks, he was arrested. They broke in his house. They even stole some belongings of the family. And they hit the wife, they hit everyone, they arrested the guy. And he disappeared for 2 weeks, and then he was released. He was released because they just did whatever they wanted. I mean, they scared him by torturing and by electric shocks and everything. And at the same time, the Hungarian embassy, of course, knew about him as a Hungarian citizen. And under pressure from the Hungarian embassy, and his news were published in Hungarian TV, in Duna TV, and in RTL. It's called RTL, right? So they released him, and during that time, his son was abroad, and his son couldn't just stay abroad and just observe like what I'm doing now. So he decided to go back to Syria. He went back to Syria. He participated in the demonstrations, and after like just less than 2 weeks ago, he was arrested, and yeah, so. Yeah, these people I know, these people, I mean, the Hungarian, my friend, before he went to Syria, he visited me in Budapest. And, like, I was convincing him, like, don't go, because, I don't know, I could feel it. Like, if he goes, he will not just stay at home. If he goes there, then he will do his best. I don't know, maybe he was just, I mean, he believed in the principles of the revolution. Of course he did. So he couldn't just, or I didn't think he would just go home and just sit at home, just to be home. No, he wanted to be a part of it. And he was even sending me emails and like messages on the mobile phone, just come and be part of it, because he felt that now he's finally doing something. So less than 2 weeks ago he was arrested, and till now, or at least like I got the news yesterday, and till yesterday nobody knows where he is. So nobody knows where, in what prison, nobody knows if he's still alive or he's dead. And he's not an exception. I mean, there are a lot of people who were, they just disappear, and some of them they were released after a few weeks. Some of them, the police brings the body to their families. And there is this myrtle called Riyath Matar. And so this guy comes from Daria, which is very close to Damascus. So the guy was, in every town, there's a group of people responsible of giving news to the specific Facebook page of their towns or their cities. And because these groups are like the main source of the Facebook Revolution page, it's called Syrian Revolution 2011, and in Arabic it's written Syrian Revolution Against Bashar al-Assad. So the main sources of this page are the smaller pages in towns. So in every town there is a group of people responsible of providing news to these news pages. Mm-hmm. And the guy was one of the organizers of this page in his town. And he participated in some demonstrations were happening in his town. So the story says that he got a call from one of his friends. He got a call from an unknown person that one of your friends is in trouble in this place, so come and help him. So the guy was running there, and there was an ambush by the police. They arrested him. It was the September the 6th. And after 3 days, the police car brought his body home. And I saw the video, and I couldn't see more than like 10 seconds. Like, the body of this guy is like all blue. His penis was cut. Some of his nails were taken off. And they threw him in front of the door, and they said to his family, take him and make shawarma out of him. Shawarma is gyros in Hungarian. So still, this is not an exception. Even like a kid called Hamza al-Khatib, I'm sure, like even Hillary Clinton was mentioned. She mentioned his name in one of her speeches. He's 14 years old, and the same happened to him. He was arrested in Daraa, and the same. Like, they cut his penis. They cut his and this Riyath Matar. They even took off his throat. And like other, there is a guy called Brahim Qashush. He comes from Hama, and he was like the singer of the revolution. So whenever they got demonstrating, he was the one who was, singing or saying things that people were repeating after him. So when the army invaded Hama, the guy was arrested, and after a few days he was found also tortured and like took off his throat. Because like, what, you say things are going to go wrong, would take off your throat. So still, all of these people are not, or myrtles, they're not an exception. So they're just like people who we know about, but like the official number, I don't know, says like 2,600 people were killed, but this is the official number. So you could multiply it by 2 or 3 or 5. So
switching to international politics for a moment, just a very simple question. Why do you think the world has intervened in Libya but not Syria?
Well, this is a big question for me, but yeah, just my personal opinion. So I'm not saying that I believe in the conspiracy theory, but it makes sense in so many cases. And the Qaddafi is, or the situation in Libya allowed to the international community to intervene with all power they've got, because I guess one of the reasons geographical, I mean, where Libya is located, like, it's different than Syria, because in Syria we have the Iraqis or the Iraq next door, who have Israel on the other side. So if the international community will interfere with the army, then the whole Middle East will explode. And so it's not the case. So the difference is that people in Syria till now, and I'm one of them, I want the international community to intervene, but not with their weapons. But the problem is that so far what they did, sanctions, and they froze some assets of Syrian Syrian personals and unofficials in the US, in some European countries, and even in Japan. And so this is what the international community is doing now. So back to the conspiracy theory. So I'm not against anyone as a person. I'm against politics of governments. So I don't say that Israelis are bad people. No, the Israeli government is bad. So the Israeli government is, I mean, it's all over the place, all over the world. So they have interests with the US, they have interests with Europe. So in my opinion, if the European Union or the US want to intervene someday with the army, like, the basic thing, or the very the main purpose of this intervention is to weaken the Arab countries, and Syria is like the first and the front. I mean, how do you call it? Front line. So I'm against any kind of intervention with the army. And all people I know, they're against it. So I don't think the international community will intervene this way. So I guess so far they're doing their best. And I'm personally thankful for these sanctions coming from the European Union or the US. So
it was said with Egypt that that the US, because of Israel, preferred a stable dictatorship in Egypt rather than an unstable democracy. And that was policy for, you know, decades, you know, regarding Egypt. Would you say the same thing? Because it took a long time before the Obama administration would finally tell Assad to leave, and it was that long moment in between that seemed very strange.
Well, still some people don't think that, or they think that the U.S. Or the European Union can do way more things, not by military, not by weapons, but they could do more things. I don't know what, but they could do more things. So the reason is that they're not doing these things that they would make real change, is that in some people's opinions that they need this stability in Middle East. So on one hand, they're saying things against government or against Al-Assad, like, we want you to step down. But the real opinion is that we say that we want you down, but we prefer that you're still in power, because this means stability for Israel. And a few months ago, I don't remember exactly if it was like months or 2 months ago, there is this businessman, and I'm making this sign, I don't know how to call it.
Quotations.
Yeah, quotation signs, businessman. It's called Rami Makhlouf, and he's first cousin of the president. And he controls basically all the big businesses in Syria, starting with the mobile providers, ending up with all kinds of technologies, pharmaceutical industry, like every big project, everybody knows it, that every big project, Rami Makhlouf is part of it. And so this guy, he's unofficial, he doesn't have any official position in the government. So he had an interview with some American newspaper, I don't remember the name of the newspaper exactly, and he said the stability of Syria is the stability of Israel. So, and of course, he didn't say this thing by himself. Like, he was told to say that. So this is, I mean, the Syrian government would never say that. But they ask some other unofficials to say that. So when people say, oh, okay, so the government wants that, then the government will easily say, no, he's unofficial. So he doesn't represent our opinion. But at the same time, he's talking to American newspapers. So he's actually giving an opinion of the government or the, opinion of the government, but like unofficially. But still, they consider it, you know?
So, in spite of all the horrible news in the past months, I mean, you do seem optimistic that the regime is going to fall sooner or later, hopefully sooner, right? I mean, when will we know, while watching the news, that things are about to change finally? I mean, what signs would I look for?
Well, the sign was, I guess, it was obvious from like the very first day when they started demonstrating in Daraa. And I'm very optimistic that the government will step down. Or, yeah, like, I mean, I could almost see it that Al-Assad is either outside the country, he took his plane and he ran away, or he's in the cage in the court. So I could almost see it in front of my eyes, but I'm not optimistic about finishing with it sooner. So I mean, I don't see any sign that government will step down in weeks or not even in 2 months, 3 months. But you never know. I mean, when the same happened in Tunisia, like nobody expected that the whole thing will end in 28 days. Like everybody's surprised that, oh, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali is just, you know, he's not here anymore. And the change or like the breakpoint in Egypt was when the army leaders decided to, yeah, like it wasn't military coup, but it was, they just decided, okay, we should stop this action. So we're like against the government. So that was the breaking point in Egypt. When the army decided, okay, we can't go with this anymore, then after a few days or after a few weeks, Mubarak was in front of the judge. So I'm very optimistic that system will change, but I'm not that optimistic about that's coming. It's coming soon. And yeah, I mean, nobody knows, as I said earlier, nobody knows what the break point, because in every country there is different situation. Every different situation there is different break point, different, you know, thing which makes the whole change. But so far, no, I'm not very optimistic that's going to be, or the end is coming soon.
Thank you, Hadi. Thank you for the interview. And we'll go back to the Syria topic later on. The Syrians have regular protests at the EU House. And also, I think at times they've had it in front of their own Syrian embassy. And as you heard from Hadi, it's a very serious thing to have these protests. Some people want to put masks on their face because they don't want to be identified by the Syrian authorities, even here in Budapest. They're afraid. But we'll go back to them, go back to that topic in a future date. But first, let's listen to some music, and we'll come back, and we'll listen to Democracy Now.
When I am gone, nothing now.
Shake down.
Only if you get free.
Shake down.
Now the gone, you're all alone.
Shake down.
You can run. And run.
A Scalar Music Hungary szervezésében Trial koncert szeptember 23-án a Dürer kertben. A lelki, erkölcsi küzdelmeket és felemelkedést, társadalmi, politikai igazságtalanságok kritikáját páratlan intelligenciával közvetítő zenekar 95-ben alakult, Seattle-ben, Washingtonban, az Egyesült Államokban. Már kétszer tette tiszteletét hazánkban. A 90-es évekbeli underground hardcore punk zenének, mozgalomnak kiemelkedő alakjai, akik értékrendükkel, intuitív zeneiségükkel generációknak adtak és adnak szellemi táplálékot és tartást. Most újabb lehetőségünk van, hogy meghallgassuk őket, és megtaláljuk vagy éppen felfedezzük azt a pontot, ahol az intelligencia a kemény zenével párosul. Trial koncert 2011. szeptember 23-án 19 órától a Dürer kertben.
Okay, again, in that last part, that was the Hungarian part was my partner in crime for this radio show, Martin Szigeti, and he's asking people to come listen to Greg Benek and his band Trial. They're going to be playing at Dürer kert in Budapest this 23rd of September at 8 p.m. And Greg Benek is the guy that's always like on the show talking about Haiti and his 100 for Haiti direct aid program that he's been doing. So 8 p.m., Dürer kert, come and see Trial. Next, we're going to listen to the September 13th, 2011 edition of Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. And she's going to be doing an extensive interview with Noam Chomsky, which I think is very interesting. This is part of, I think, like a series of interviews that they've had where the topic is 10 years after September 11, etc. Some of it is about U.S. domestic politics, which is okay, interesting. But the two most interesting things are Chomsky talking about September 11 and how he sees the facts, and I think he's a very level-headed man on the issue of 9/11. It's so easy to get into all sorts of crazy conspiracy theories that have very weak evidence, and there's a lot of things that need to be asked about 9/11. But Chomsky always just deals with the facts as they're presented, and he analyzes them, and he's just very logical and level-headed about it. I just appreciate Chomsky's way of looking at the world, even on the issue of 9/11. I think he's just very good. And then also he's going to be talking about this coming week's vote in the United Nations about Palestinian statehood. And we're going to address this probably this coming week, the whole issue of Palestinian statehood. And, well, we don't know. I'll tell you what's going to happen. I could write the story already. It's going to be rejected by the Security Council, UN recognition of a Palestinian state. It'll go to the General Assembly probably, and then it'll be like voted on massively by most countries in the world. And so you'll have this, nothing will actually change in the end. You have a majority of countries in the world support a Palestinian state, but one country is going to veto it on the Security Council. And want to take a guess? Which country will that be? It'll be the United States. So we've been here before, like so many things in the Middle East. It's just kind of this skipping old style LP record that just keeps skipping and playing the same song over and over again. But this time it could be different because of it will kind of change the how diplomacy is done in the future. But we'll talk more about that later. Let's listen to Democracy Now! September 13th, an extensive interview with Noam Chomsky.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue to mark the decade since the September 11th attacks in the United States, today we spend the hour with MIT professor, world-renowned political dissident, linguist, and author Noam Chomsky. In the months after 9/11, as the Bush administration attacked Afghanistan and geared up for the invasion of Iraq, Noam Chomsky released a small book that provided the definitive counter-narrative to the jingoism of the time. The book was called simply 9/11, a collected series of interviews Chomsky had given on the roots of the 9/11 attacks and his prescription for a just response. At a time when lawmakers from both sides of the aisle joined together to authorize endless war, Chomsky's was the leading voice to call for a look in the mirror, for a rethinking of U.S. actions in the Middle East and across the globe. 9/11 went on to become a surprise bestseller. 10 years later, Professor Chomsky has just released an updated version. It's called 9/11, Was There an Alternative? Was There an Alternative refers to the U.S. assassination of Osama bin Laden and the continuity Chomsky sees between the Bush administration's foreign policy and President Obama's. Today, we'll speak with Noam Chomsky about the decade since 9/11, at a time when the U.S. is at war in several areas, at home in continued economic turmoil. Noam Chomsky's just returned from Iceland and Norway. He's joining us from Boston, Massachusetts. And I'm joined here in New York for this interview by Democracy Now! Producer Aaron Mate, who covered the thwarted Gaza-bound aid flotilla in Greece. Welcome, Aaron, joining me in this interview. It's good to have you with us.
Thanks, Amy.
And thanks so much, Noam Chomsky, for being with us so soon after you've come back from your trip. Noam, why don't we begin with this new book? You wrote 9/11 10 years ago, what became the definitive counter-narrative at the time. What did you feel was important to understand then, and now with Was There an Alternative?
Well, as you mentioned, it wasn't really a book. It was a collection of interviews, the ones that we were able to get transcripts for. Some of them we couldn't. There were a number of things that I thought had to be pointed out. By now, I think they're hardly even controversial. But one was that the claim that the U.S. was being attacked because, as the president put it, they hate our freedoms, was completely untenable. They hated our policy. In fact, it would be more accurate to say we hate their freedoms. There's plenty of documentation about that, you know, going back to the 1950s. Shortly after the president's speech, the Pentagon had a study of this, and they concluded, yes, it's not that they hate our freedoms, it's they hate our policies. And as I say, evidence about that is enormous, back to the 50s. So, for example, in 1958, President Eisenhower, in internal documents long since released, raised the question with his staff about why there's a campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world. He said, not from the governments, but from the people. And the National Security Council, major planning body, had just released a study on this in which they said that they concluded that there's a perception in the Arab world that the United States supports harsh, oppressive dictatorships, and that the U.S. blocks democracy and development, and that we do it because we want to keep control over their energy resources. And I went on to say that this is fairly accurate, and that's pretty much what we should be doing as long as the populations are kept quiet. And it's so it goes on. I won't run through the details, but so it goes on until the present. In fact, right at this moment, Obama has succeeded in descending even below George W. Bush in approval in the Arab world. It's minuscule, few percent. And it's the policies, same policy. The policies change, but they're hostile. So one thing is we should understand where atrocities come from. They don't come from nowhere. And if we're serious, we should try to do something about what is the basis for them. That's been the other issue, which was important, and I think we have a lot more evidence about it now, is that there probably were much more constructive alternatives. The attack on the the 9/11 attack was pretty harshly criticized in the throughout the Muslim world, but particularly in the jihadi movement. Fatwas from leading clerics, harsh condemnation. It's very likely that it would have been possible then to split the jihadi movement, to isolate al-Qaeda, to move to apprehend the suspects. And of course, in our system of justice, theoretically, people are suspects until they're sentenced. So to apprehend the suspects, treat it as a criminal action, try to make use of the fact that there was tremendous antagonism to this, even among the jihadi movement, and move on to a much more constructive relationship with the general Muslim Arab world. Well, that path wasn't taken. The path that was taken was to lash out violently, first in Afghanistan, then in Iraq. That simply was kind of following Osama bin Laden's playbook. Actually, that was pointed out pretty quickly by people like Michael Scheuer, he didn't identify himself then, has since, the CIA, head of the CIA task force that was tracking bin Laden. He ended up concluding the United States is bin Laden's best ally. We're helping. His goal was to mobilize the Muslim world around the fear that the United States was attacking Islam, was carrying out a crusade, they have to defend themselves, and we helped. The invasion of Iraq particularly gave a big shot in the arm to the jihadi extremists. It was predicted by U.S. and British intelligence agencies, that's been released since, that the attack on Iraq would increase terror, and it did, by a factor of 7 the first year, according to RAND Corporation, quasi-governmental statistics. Well, that's what happens when you lash out violently without seeking to understand the nature of what's happening and pursuing the options for diplomatic, peaceful, negotiated settlements and treating crimes as crimes. When there's a crime, you try to identify the likely perpetrators, apprehend them, bring them to a fair trial. It's very likely that could have been done at the time. We don't know. There were tentative offers from the Taliban to allow a trial of bin Laden. It was not pursued. It was the U.S. just dismissed it. We don't talk to you. Well, could that have succeeded? We can only speculate. It surely could have been done on May 2nd when U.S. Commandos, Navy SEALs apprehended bin Laden, defenseless, was with his wife, no arms, no, apprehended him and assassinated him, then dumped his body at sea. Now that's kind of an action which is just bound to increase speculation, cynicism, doubt, quite different from what in fact should have been done. Actually, one of the leading British legal specialist, civil libertarian, who incidentally approved of the action, nevertheless pointed out that the way it was carried out was criminal and dangerous in its implications. He compared it to the treatment of the far more horrendous war criminals after the Second World War. He pointed out that the British government wanted to just kill the Nazi leaders, but the U.S. government, or Truman, insisted that they be tried. They followed And in fact, then came the Nuremberg trials, which had their flaws, but at least did bring out in public the nature of the crimes. They also led to quite an important conclusion by the chief prosecutor, U.S. chief prosecutor, Justice Robert Jackson. He informed the tribunal in rather eloquent words that, we, as he put it, we are handing these defendants a poison chalice. And if we ever sip from it, if we ever commit such crimes as aggression, one of the major crimes, then we must suffer the same punishment, or else essentially the trial's a farce. And that's a choice we've had to make since, not the right answer, in my opinion.
We're talking to Noam Chomsky, professor emeritus at MIT. He has a new book out 10 years after his book, 9/11. It is called 9/11, Was There an Alternative?, with a new essay written after the assassination of Osama bin Laden. We'll come back to this discussion in a minute. The Drum Thing by John Coltrane. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting over 950 stations on Pacifica and NPR stations, on community and college stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375 and Channel 348. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are available in Spanish for any radio station to take, as over 300 are. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Our guest for the hour is MIT professor Noam Chomsky. His latest book is called 9/11, Was There an Alternative? That last question, was there an alternative, referring to the assassination of Osama bin Laden. Aaron?
Well, Noam, you mentioned the changes in discourse between 10 years ago and today. And actually, this issue of the reasons behind 9/11 came up last night at the Republican presidential debate. Congressmember Ron Paul of Texas drew boos from the crowd and a rebuke from other candidates on the podium when he criticized U.S. foreign policy in discussing the roots of 9/11.
We're under great threat because we occupy so many countries. We're in 130 countries. We have 900 bases around the world. We're going broke. The purpose of Al-Qaeda was to attack us, invite us over there where they can target us. And they have been doing it. They have more attacks against us and the American interests per month than occurred in all the years before 9/11. But we're there occupying their land. And if we think that we can do that and not have retaliation, we're kidding ourselves. We have to be honest with ourselves. What would we do if another country, say China, did to us what we do to all those countries over there? So this whole idea that the whole Muslim world is responsible for this and they're attacking us because we're free and prosperous, that is just not true. Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda have been explicit. They have been explicit, and they wrote and said that we attacked America because you had bases on our holy land in Saudi Arabia, you do not give Palestinians a fair treatment, and you have been bombing. didn't say that. I'm trying to get you to understand what the motive was behind the bombing. At the same time, we had been bombing and killing hundreds of thousands of Iraqis for 10 years. Would you be annoyed? If you're not annoyed, then there's some problem.
That was Republican Congressmember Ron Paul of Texas speaking last night at the Republican presidential debate. Noam Chomsky, your response.
I think what he said is completely uncontroversial. You can read it in government documents. You can find it in polls. Maybe people don't like to hear it, but as I mentioned before, it goes back to the 1950s. Actually, right after 9/11, the Wall Street Journal, to its credit, did a study of privileged Muslims, sometimes called moneyed Muslims, people in the Muslim world who are deeply embedded in the U.S. Global project, lawyers, directors of multinational corporations, and so on, not the general population. And it was very much like what Eisenhower had was concerned about and the National Security Council in the 1950s. There was a lot of antagonism to U.S. Policy in the region, partly support of dictators blocking democracy and development, just as the National Security Council concluded in 1958. Also, by then, by 2001, there were much more specific things, very much a lot of anger about the U.S. backing for the way Israeli occupation of the occupied territories, settlements, the bitter oppression of the Palestinians, and also something that isn't discussed much here, but meant a lot there. And remember, these are privileged Muslims, leaders of those who kind of carry out, implement the general U.S. economic and social policies in the region. The other thing besides the Israeli support of Israeli crimes was the sanctions against Iraq. This is 2001, remember. The sanctions against Iraq were brutal and destructive. They killed hundreds of thousands of people. The both of the international diplomats who administered the oil for food program, distinguished international diplomats, Dennis Halliday, Hans von Sponeck, in sequence, both of them resigned in protest because they regarded the sanctions as genocidal. They were carrying out a kind of a mass slaughter of Iraqis. They were strengthening Saddam Hussein. They were compelling the population to rely on him just for survival. These were major crimes of the 1990s. And privileged Muslims, moneyed Muslims in Saudi Arabia, elsewhere, they were bitterly opposed to this, not because they hate our freedoms, because they don't like murderous and brutal policies.
Noam, before you were quoting a CIA analyst saying that the U.S. had actually become Osama bin Laden's biggest ally through being drawn into so many wars abroad, and talking about how all this engagement has undermined U.S. standing. Well, what has this decade of war meant here at home for the domestic situation and how that relates to bin Laden's goals of bleeding the United States?
Yeah, he was pretty explicit about that. He wanted to draw the United States into what intelligence agencies called a trap, which would inflame and incite hostility in the Muslim world. He hoped help mobilize people for his cause. I don't think that happened, but also bankrupt the U.S. at home. I mean, current estimates. There's a recent estimate study at Brown University estimated the cost just of the two wars at about $4 trillion. If you count in the costs of, Homeland Security and so on, probably doubles that. That's pretty serious. That's the between the wars, the housing bubble, and Bush's tax cuts for the rich. That it creates the economic crisis that we're now in.
On Monday, President Obama sent his new jobs proposal to Congress. In a new challenge to Republicans, Obama said he would propose paying the $447 billion package by raising taxes on the wealthy. Around $400 billion would be raised by eliminating a number of deductions claimed by wealthy taxpayers. Obama discussed the bill in a White House speech.
On Thursday, I told Congress that I'll be sending them a bill called the American Jobs Act. Well, here it is. This is a bill that will put people back to work all across the country. This is the bill that will help our economy in a moment of national crisis. This is a bill that is based on ideas from both Democrats and Republicans. And this is the bill that Congress needs to pass. No games, no politics, no delays. I'm sending this bill to Congress today, and they ought to pass it immediately.
Noam Chomsky, what is your assessment of President Obama, whether we're talking about his new jobs plan or whether we're talking about his foreign policy?
Well, I can't say that I find it disappointing because, quite frankly, I never expected anything. Actually, I wrote about it before the primaries, just based on his record and his website. I should say, first of all, that this latest jobs plan is one of the better things he's done, I think. I don't think it goes anywhere near far enough, but at least it has elements that are going in the right direction. During the lame duck session, the serious question was whether what to do with the Bush tax cuts. The Bush tax cuts were carefully designed so that at the beginning everyone got a little and you had a feeling taxes are being reduced. But they were designed so that as the 10-year period ended, it was overwhelmingly going to the very rich. Now, the population is strongly opposed to that. You take a look at polls during the lame duck session when this was coming up. Very strong support for increasing taxes for those with incomes over, say, $250,000 a year. Well, Obama didn't push that. If he had appealed to the public, they, I think, could have overcome the opposition of the financial institutions, the new Republican congressional delegation, and so on. But he didn't even try. And that should be done. Now, the current proposal goes partially in that direction by indirectly increasing taxes through elimination of deductions. But the tax code simply has to be revised. It's become highly regressive. In fact, the share of GDP, national income, of taxes is probably lower than it's ever been, far lower than 20 or 30 years ago, particularly for the rich. All of that should be adjusted. There is a stimulus in the program, which is a good idea, but it's much too small. The concentration on deficit reduction, when the problem is, the serious problem is massive unemployment, I think that's a very serious error. You can understand why the banks and insurance companies and so on like it, but it's completely wrong for trying to extricate ourselves from quite a serious economic crisis. Other things are, unfortunately, the deficit itself, if you want to take it seriously, I don't think it's the major issue by any means. In fact, I don't even think it's a serious issue, at least in the short term. But if you do want to take it seriously, it's pretty easy to trace it to the roots. Dean Baker, a very good economist, has pointed out the calculations would show that if the United States had a health care program similar to other industrial countries, which is not a utopian dream, not only would there be no deficit, but there'd be a surplus. That plus the huge military budget military budget's probably half the deficit. It's way out of line with anything needed, certainly for any defensive purpose, but for any justifiable purpose. Ron Paul, who you heard before, was quite right about that. If the military, the U.S. is spending about as much as the rest of the world combined, almost, on military spending, technologically very advanced, new destructive techniques developing far beyond what any other country has. This is all, first of all, it shouldn't be done on principle, but it also ends up being harmful to us, essentially for the reasons that Paul mentioned. And very expensive, of course. That plus the hopelessly dysfunctional healthcare system, those are fundamental problems that have to be addressed. Now, that could have been addressed at the time of the healthcare reform. A large part of, depending on how the question was asked, either a large plurality, often a majority of the population, was in favor of some form of national health care, which would be incomparably more efficient and more humane. But Obama just dropped that. The public option remained as a possibility. That was supported by, I think, maybe almost two-thirds of the population. Obama just dropped it. So everything is in the hands of the insurance companies. We continue to have roughly twice the per capita health care costs of comparable countries, some of the poorest outcomes. And it's the only large, almost unregulated privatized system. Yes, it's highly inefficient. It's also very inhumane, not to speak of tens of thousands of people without insurance or many more with not enough insurance. Well, that can be changed. It should be changed. If it could, the deficit issues, such as they are, I think they're secondary, would largely disappear. There's a long-term debt problem. That's a different matter. And that can be dealt with. The best way to deal, we can trace that to its roots, too. Ronald Reagan, who was fiscally totally irresponsible, tripled the U.S. debt, shifted the U.S. very quickly from the world's leading creditor to the world's leading debtor. George W. Bush enhanced it with his fiscal policies, including the huge tax cut for the rich, the wars, and in the long term, that's a problem. But the way to deal with that problem in the long term is with economic growth, appropriate economic growth, sensible economic growth. Well, that can be done, but it's not going to be done through deficit reduction programs or tampering with entitlements, as is on the table, unfortunately. So there were elements in infrastructure development is significant, and Obama mentioned it. There's small programs. I think that those are, he talked about work sharing, which is quite an important proposal. I don't know if anything will be done. That was done in Germany, and it cut down unemployment very sharply, led to substantial economic growth even through the recession. Those are options that could be pursued. They're mentioned. They should be pushed harder. They should be expanded. But at least there are elements there that could turn into a constructive program. However, not until the core issues are handled. One is enormous unemployment. That's the worst problem, and it's becoming almost permanent unemployment. Another is the deterioration of manufacturing, meaning offshoring of manufacturing. The only way that can be dealt with is by cutting back on the overvalued dollar that would improve possibilities for exports. The healthcare system, which is grotesque, it's an international scandal. The huge military spending, the very low taxes for the rich by comparative standards, also corporations and so on. Those are problems that, those are fundamental problems that have to be dealt with if there's going to be anything like successful economic and social development in the United States.
Noam, you mentioned entitlements, and obviously this is an issue that's come up a lot in the deficit debate. Governor Rick Perry, the Republican presidential hopeful, has called it a Ponzi scheme. But even Democrats seem to buy into this narrative that it's in crisis. Can you address that?
Social Security's not in any crisis. I mean, the trust fund alone will fully pay benefits for, I think, another 30 years or so. And after that, taxes will give almost the same benefits. To worry about a possible a problem 30 years from now, which can incidentally be fixed with a little bit of tampering here and there, as was done in 1983, to worry about that just makes absolutely no sense unless you're trying to destroy the program. It's a very successful program. A large number of people rely on it. It doesn't pay munificently, but it at least keeps people alive, not just retired people, people with disabilities and others. Very low administrative costs, extremely efficient, and no burden on the deficit, doesn't add to the deficit. The effort to try to present Social Security program as if it's a major problem, that's just a hidden way of trying to undermine and destroy it. Now, there has been a lot of opposition to it since the 1930s on the part of sectors of extreme wealth and privilege, especially financial capital. They don't like it for several reasons. One is the rich don't barely. For them, it's meaningless. Anyone with who's had a fairly decent income, it's a tiny addition to your retirement, but doesn't mean much. Another is if the financial institutions, the insurance companies, can get their hands on this huge financial resource, for example, if it's privatized in some way or vouchers, I mean, that's a huge bonanza. They'll have trillions of dollars to play with, the banks, the investment firms, and so on. But I think myself that there's a more subtle reason why they're opposed to it, and I think it's rather similar to the reason for the effort to pretty much dismantle the public education system. Social Security is based on a principle. It's based on the principle that you care about other people. You care whether the widow across town, disabled widow, is going to be able to have food to eat. And that's a notion you have to drive out of people's heads. The idea of solidarity, sympathy, mutual support, that's doctrinally dangerous. The preferred doctrines are just care about yourself, don't care about anyone else. Very good way to trap and control people. And the very idea that that we're in it together, that we care about each other, that we have responsibility for one another, that's sort of frightening to those who want a society which is dominated by power, authority, wealth, and which people are passive and obedient. And I suspect, I don't know how to measure it exactly, but I think that that's a considerable part of the drive on the part of small privileged sectors to undermine a very efficient, very effective system on which a large part of the population relies more than ever, because wealth, personal wealth, was very much tied up in the housing market. That was people's personal wealth. Well, okay, that quite predictably totally collapsed. People aren't destitute by the standards of, slums in India or Southern Africa, but very suffering severely, and they have nothing else to rely on but what the really pittance that they're getting from Social Security. To take that away would be just disastrous.
We're talking to Noam Chomsky. He has a new book out 10 years after his book 9/11. This is called 9/11, Was There an Alternative? We'll come back to this conversation in a minute. And if you'd like to get a copy of the full show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Stay with us.
total destruction. Behold the solution. And there ain't no use. No one can stop her now.
Real Situation by Bob Marley. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Democracy Now!'s Aaron Mate. We're talking to Noam Chomsky, professor emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has written over 100 books, has just returned from Norway and Iceland. His latest book, 9/11, Was There an Alternative? As the Palestinian Authority launched its bid for statehood recognition at the UN last week, the Obama administration confirmed it would veto any statehood measure that came before the Security Council. This is State Department spokesperson Victoria Nuland.
It should not come as a shock to anyone in this room that the U.S. opposes a move in New York by the Palestinians to try to establish a state that can only be achieved through negotiations. So, yes, if something comes to a vote in the U.N. Security Council, the U.S. will veto.
And President Obama has affirmed this. Noam Chomsky, your response.
Well, unfortunately, it's quite consistent with past practice. The list of U.S. vetoes at the Security Council to protect Israeli aggression and occupation is huge. The most recent one, which actually got some attention because it was so outlandish, was last February when Obama vetoed a Security Council resolution endorsing official U.S. policy. Look at the resolution, its core part was opposing expansion of Israeli settlements in the West Bank. That's supposed to be U.S. policy. Obama vetoed it. If the Palestinians do bring the issue to the Security Council and the U.S. vetoes it, it'll be just another indication of the real unwillingness to permit a settlement of this issue in terms of what has been for a long time an overwhelming international consensus. And this goes back a long time. The first relevant U.S. veto was in January 1976, 35 years ago. The major Arab states, so-called confrontation states, Syria, Egypt, Jordan, brought a resolution to the Security Council calling for a two-state settlement on the international border. And then the resolution incorporated the basic wording of UN 242, which everyone agrees, at least in theory, is the basic Security Council document, called for a recognition of the rights of every state in the region, that would include Israel, a new Palestinian state, to exist in peace and security within secure and recognized boundaries, wording approximately like that. U.S. vetoed it. Another veto in 1980, similar resolution. Long series since, then things shifted to the General Assembly, where there are almost annual votes with numbers like 150-3, and so on. U.S., Israel, sometimes the Pacific Island, El Salvador. And this is just continuing right up to the present. There are pretty ugly ones, too. The U.S. has blocked ceasefire efforts at the time of Israeli attacks. In fact, Obama himself, you take a look at his, I don't know if he still has it, but in his website prior to the election, there was a section on the Middle East, and it's worth looking at. It gives you an indication of what's been happening since. It's full of, adoration of Israel. You expect that. Practically not a word about the Palestinians. A few phrases saying maybe they should have some rights. But that was right in the middle of the latest Israeli invasion of Lebanon, 2006. Brutal, murderous invasion without any credible pretext. You'd go into that. Actually, the fifth such invasion And Obama took pride in his webpage in having co-sponsored a Senate resolution right in the middle of the invasion, insisting that nothing be done to impede Israel's attack in Lebanon, and that the U.S. should censure and maybe sanction anyone who tried to interfere with it, Iran and Syria. So let them, they must be able to go on to achieve their objectives, killing 1,000 Lebanese, again destroying a large part of the country, and so on. That's Obama. When after he was elected, Israel attacked Gaza, major attack on Gaza, late December 2008, right through January 2009. Obama was, I'm sure your listeners are familiar with that, horrible, atrocious attack. The United States blocked efforts at the Security Council to establish a ceasefire to end the atrocities. Obama was repeatedly asked, would he say something about it? His answer was, there's only one president. I can't say anything about it. He was saying all sorts of other things, but not this.
Campaign. We only have a few minutes, so I want to cut you off to get in a few more questions. Actually, one last question, if we have time, which is that you've written about what it would mean for Israel and the U.S. if this statehood bid is passed at the U.N. And, of course, this debate is coming up very soon, scheduled to take place at the General Assembly in the coming weeks. What would it mean if the U.N. passes statehood for the Palestinians?
Well, that's really up to us to decide. I mean, there could be a very harsh reaction on the part of the United States and Israel. The Congress, U.S. Congress, has already declared that it's going to cut off funding, wants to cut off funding to the Palestinian Authority. Israel controls much of their funds through control of customs, transfer of finance. They all go through Israel. They could cut it off. The Palestinians could be in very serious economic trouble, financial trouble, if the U.S. and Israel, acting jointly, react to any kind of statehood bid by simply cutting off the funding on which they rely. It's Israel for decades has prevented any independent development, serious economic development in the territories. There is, the numbers show economic growth that's highly reliant on outside aid, very artificial, and that could be a very serious blow to the Palestinians. The role that Egypt plays will also be significant, especially with regard to Gaza. My guess is that some kind of compromise position will be worked out, which will provide enhanced observer status to the Palestinians at the United Nations, maybe short of what would trigger U.S. and Israel from simply pulling out the rug from under their survival.
No, we have to leave it there. We have to leave it there for the global show, but we're going to continue, and people can go to our website for a web exclusive at democracynow.org. Noam Chomsky, Professor Emeritus at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, his latest book is 9/11, Was There an Alternative? You can go to our website for our other web exclusive, 9/11 Decade, that showcases our vast archive of in-depth reporting over the last decade. We also have a job opening, audio-visual archive. For more information, go to democracynow.org, where the show is available as well. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Mate. Thanks for joining us.
Interrupting all programs. Radio crash on pirate satellite, orbiting your living room, cashing in the Bill of Rights. Human army surplus or refusing of the lights. This is radio crash on pirate satellite. Yeah.
love in Vietnam, giving deadly exhibitions of murder by napalm.
That was Democracy Now! With an interview with Noam Chomsky. Thank you for listening. One more thing. This 23rd of September, 8 p.m. at Duer Kert in Budapest, Greg Binnick, which you've heard in the show many times before, he and his band are going to be playing at Duer Kert. So 8 p.m. Be there. It'll be a great show. And thanks again for everybody who's listening. You can always find us online at lmv.hu/Mindenki Yoga. And you spell Mindenki Yoga like this, MINDENKIJOGA. And you can find us on Facebook. Just type in Mindenki Yoga. And you can also send us email. Send us email at mindenkiyoga@mailbox.hu. Love email. So thanks for listening and talk to you again this coming week.